In 1972 or 1973, or maybe in 1974, my mother and father hosted a dangerous New Year's Eve party at our home in Wellpinits, Washington, on the Spokane Indian Reservation. We lived in a two-story house. The first floor was a doorless daylight basement, while the elevated second floor had front and back doors accessible by 14-step staircases. The house was constructed by our tribe using grant money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, more tersely known as HUD. Our family HUD house was new, but only half finished when we moved in, and remains unfinished and illogically designed over 40 years later. It was worth $25,000 when it was built, and I think it's probably worth about the same now. I don't speak my tribal language, but I'm positive there are no Spokane Indian words for real estate appreciation. I don't recall the moment when I officially became a storyteller, a talented liar, but here I must quote Simon Ortiz, the Acoma Pueblo writer, who said, quote, "Listen, if it's fiction, then it better be true," end quote. Simon, a beautiful storyteller, doesn't remember ever saying such a thing. "That sounds like something I might say," he said to me, "but I don't know if I have ever said that particular thing." I don't remember when I first learned of the quote. Did I read it in one of Simon's poems or stories? If so, then why doesn't Simon remember that he wrote it? Can a writer forget something that he's written in one of his own books? Yes, of course. I wrote my first novel over 2 decades ago, and fans often stump me by asking questions about passages that I don't remember writing. So perhaps I read that quote somewhere else and have mistakenly attributed it to Simon. Or did I hear somebody else quote Simon? So, okay, maybe I am unreliable to some degree. But despite what my teachers, parents, friends, siblings, and I say about my storytelling, about my labyrinth, about my fantasy life, I also know that I have an excellent memory. To quote a song lyric I vaguely remember from a song and band I can't fully recall, "I remember everything." He goes on to tell us about that New Year's Eve party in their HUD house on the Spokane Indian Reservation in 1973 or 1972 or 1974. And he goes on to write, "I was only 7 years old, but I knew with a fundamentalist fervor that the party was potentially lethal. Not because of my mother and father's actions, but because of their inattentions. They were alcoholics who'd get what they laughingly called bottle blind, as in, I was so bottle blind that I didn't even realize I'd driven off the road until I woke up with a pine tree branch sticking through the car windshield about 4 inches from my nose." That's what my father said, or approximately what he said, after his 11th or 19th or 27th drunken car wreck. So yes, my bottle blind parents invited everybody on the reservation to that dangerous New Year's Eve party, including two Indian men who were widely believed, who were known to have committed murders. The story goes on. Things get kind of rough, and young Sherman Alexei tells us, "I was still awake at midnight when the party went into full crazy mode with singing and screaming and cursing and pistols and rifles fired into the night sky. Those reservation Indian parties felt less like celebrations and more like ceremonial preparation for the battle that never quite arrived." He is whisked out of his home at one point by his mother. They drive into town, and as Sherman is talking to a waitress who is helping them in that small town at that cafe after that wild and horrendous party back at their house, "My mom saved us," I said. "She saved us from drunks." The waitress looked down at my bare and dirty feet. My mother had dragged her kids out of the house without putting socks and shoes on us. It was winter. But I don't remember if my bare feet felt cold. They had to be cold. But I don't trust this particular detail. I don't believe we left the house with bare feet. There's no way our mother made us walk with bare feet in the snow and ice. She would not have done that to us, right? I think my mind is adding a Dickensian detail to heighten the narrative punch. I hope our bare winter feet are only a metaphor or simile. I hope it means, quote, "our cheap shoes weren't much better than bare feet," end quote. "I'm hungry," I said. "I'm thirsty." Waitress brought us our breakfast. Then she said that she'd pay for it when my mother said she didn't have any money. And then, as we prepared to leave the diner, the kind waitress needed to help us even more. "You take those kids somewhere safe," the waitress told my mother. "Don't go back to the place you ran from." I don't remember my mother's response to that waitress. I can only imagine my mother's desperation and fear. She wanted to escape. She wanted to rescue her kids. But where could she go? Was there a place where she and her kids could be safe? Has there ever been a place in the United States where a poor Native woman and her kids could truly be safe? She had no money. She had no knowledge of family shelters. Did those even exist in the early 1970s? She must have debated her options. She knew that Indian children were often taken away from their families for the flimsiest of reasons, as a late 20th century continuation of official government assimilation and termination efforts. Split up, separated, we kids would be sent to foster homes, where we'd be in potential danger. We might be sent to the last Indian boarding schools, where we would definitely be in danger. Our mother had already lost us once in social services. A second time might mean she'd lose us for good. She couldn't risk it. She couldn't trust any white officials. She had to go home. So my mother drove us back to the reservation, back to our HUD house. Almost all the partygoers were gone that New Year's Eve day. My father, scratched and bloody and bruised, was asleep in his bed. My mother and my siblings and I crawled into bed with him. We slept all day and long into the night. At some point, my mother woke alone and cleaned the house. Then she woke us, her children, and promised us that she would stop drinking booze that very second and would never drink again. My mother was a liar. She broke many promises over the coming decades, but she kept the greatest of vows. She was sober for the rest of her life, and that's why I am still alive. Well, that's the beginning, the opening of You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a memoir by Sherman Alexie. Perhaps you know that name. Sherman Alexie has been a favorite storyteller of mine for many, many years. And he's been a favorite of many other readers as well, given even a quick review of his popularity with booksellers, with librarians, and of course, with readers. Why? Well, for lots of reasons, I'm sure, but most of all because Sherman Alexie is a storyteller who draws us readers into his books with quietly expressed emotional appeals. You heard a lot of that in that opening that I read from the book. And then surprises us, just as we're settling into characters and storylines, with a twist that turns the story and often the characters into surprising directions. Sometimes pleasing ones, always surprising ones. His novels range from folksy, sometimes even children's novels, to much more adult-themed tales of love, sex, danger, depression, and just often enough, redemption. His novels, his prose, his poetry are worth a reader's time, and his short stories are delightfully turned and encapsulated reads as well. You Don't Have to Say You Love Me is not the novel we're used to having from Alexie, but it's more of a memoir than an autobiography. You Don't Have to Say You Love Me is a memoir based on Alexie's life and its ongoing intersection with his mother, the good, the bad, the yet to be understood, as the relationship was and as it is as she dies, not as he wished it could be. This is Sherman Alexie laying his emotional life on the line as a son, as a brother, as a husband, as a father, as a Native American, as a res boy who made it rich, as a famous author of prose, of poetry, and of music. And it's true. We all come from somewhat different backgrounds, different upbringings as children. We all end up living, more often than not, in the same polymorphous American society. So it is with our author. Sherman Alexie grew up, as a reader of the first chapter in this book will know, on an Indian reservation in western Washington state. And that experience brings a certain collection of experiences with it, as growing up in a big city suburb or in a rural farm country brings their own experiences. And in the very first chapters of You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, Alexie uses his personal, close, but not too intimate style of writing to share some of those memories and lasting emotional experiences. He's not afraid or reluctant to lay it all out for us. Some good, some bad, some pop cultural memories from back in the day, they all come together to give us a better, more rounded look at this popular author. As a reader, I've got to respect the gutsiness of Sherman Alexing laying out before us the often raw emotion we read here. And as a reader, I feel I've come to know one of my favorite writers and the motivations for his characters, no doubt, better as a result. We learn much about Alexing's experiences with Native American life, his insights into a Native American thought, from the ground up, as interpreted for us through the stories of his life, those of his family, those of his neighbors. Modern life for Native Americans, for those who grew up on today's reservations, is portrayed by Alexing as often a life of violence, of alcohol, emotional emptiness. Yet there is not unending dreariness, and this memoir is certainly not without hope. Alexing points to friends, family members who support each other in times of too often daily crisis, whose dream of a better life. But in this searingly honest memoir, Alexing tells us again and again that his familial guilt and the personal angst is strong nonetheless. The narrative is told through alternating chapters of prose and poetry. A narrative trick of the eye, more than of emotion or a flow, though the different writing formats do set the chapters apart from each other, allowing, even encouraging the reader to sit up and take notice, the main theme at hand. In sum, I'm glad I took the time to read You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. In time, it will require. It's over 400 pages in length. Parts are certainly not easy to experience, but so much of Alexing's emotional life is laid out here that in the end, it is an experience I would not have wanted to miss. Maybe you will say the same thing if you take up the time to read You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. I want to finish by reading from the very last pages of the book. Sherman Alexing's mother has passed away. He has gone through mourning stages. He has gone through life as a son who wasn't quite sure that he loved his mother as much as she loved him, or maybe he loved her even more. It's an ongoing struggle in his mind and his emotion and his spirit. But he ends the book with this passage, with this experience that he shares with us. A few weeks after our mother's funeral, and a few days after my adventure with the bird, I sat with my therapist and told her about the little creature's pacing and shaking on our deck. "I don't know if I ever told you," my therapist said, "but I'm a birder. I love birds. And when they hit a window like that in your story, or get hurt in any significant way, they have this ritual. They shake off the pain. They shake off the trauma. And they walk in circles to reconnect their brain and body and soul. When your bird was walking and shaking, it was remembering and relearning how to be a bird." Oh, wow. I couldn't say much after that intense revelation, but my therapist continued. "We humans often lose touch with our bodies," she said. "We forget that we can also shake away our pain and trauma." "It seems so simple," Alexing writes. "I openly doubted that it could be true. But that night, I stood on our deck. In the same place where that bird had fallen, arose, walked, shook, and flew. And I performed that ritual too. I shook my arms, legs, head, and body. I paced in small circles that grew larger by the minute. I reached toward every other constellation. I reached toward my sisters, niece, and brothers. I reached toward the memory of my mother. And as I continued to shake, I felt a sparrow-sized pain rise from my body and, wait, 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 listen. I don't know how or when my grieving will end, but I'm always relearning how to be human again." It's an incredibly moving and thoughtful read. You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a memoir by Sherman Alexing about himself, his family, and most particularly about his mother. It's available at the West Lafayette Public Library and at all of our fine public libraries.